Nanotechnology. Will the advent of the new nanotechnological era result in a great benefit for mankind? Or will it instead prove to be disastrous? Let's take a look. Hello, everybody. This is Gary Benoit, your host for Beyond the Cover. And today we have with us Dennis Barron, who is the publisher of the New American Magazine.
Hello, Gary. Thank you for having me on your show.
Okay, thank you, Dennis. And of course, Dennis, you just wrote the recent cover story in the January 31st issue of the New American Magazine, Nanotechnology, a Double-Edged Sword. Dennis, what is nanotechnology? Because I'm sure a lot of people are unfamiliar with the term. And also, what makes it a double-edged sword?
Well, first of all, nanotechnology refers to technology that takes place on scales at the nanotech level, which is from 1 nanometer to 100 nanometers in size. And that's hard to envision in our macro world that we inhabit every day. But if you think about the thickness of one single sheet of newspaper print, so in your local newspaper, for instance, that's 100,000 nanometers thick. So we're talking about something that's only a fraction of the thickness of a newspaper. So very, very, very tiny scale. You can't see these things with the naked eye. You really would need an electron microscope to be able to look at this. And nanotechnology is a technology that encompasses many things taking place at the nanoscale with regard to impacts in a wide range of areas of technology that we utilize every day. Things that include materials development, so research into the very basic materials that things are constructed of, to drug delivery, pharmaceuticals, and even nanoscale robotics.
Okay, robotics. So can you give an example of that?
Well, nanoscale robotics could include a wide range of different types of what are called nanorobots that could be used to provide a number of services. There's a great deal of research going on right now, for instance, with nanorobots as diagnostic devices that can be used within the human body or within other biological systems for, you know, as I said, diagnostics or even as for drug delivery. So how do you deliver drugs in a targeted fashion to a specific site? So you can imagine the implications of that sort of target delivery, where you can control a nanorobot that can control the delivery of a particular chemistry that might be, for instance, having anti-cancer properties to fight a particular tumor. So one of the great benefits of nanotechnology research is it really ratchets up the level of sophistication of the technology that we're able to bring to bear as a culture on a variety of problems in the marketplace. Cancer treatment, treatment for people who have lost the ability to control their limbs, so paralytics type of treatments for those types of things, neurological diseases. But in the realm of material science, you might be talking about basic research into self-repair for materials that might suffer stress and damage over time of their use. So, for instance, concrete, steel, things that are potentially liable to oxidation. There may be nanotechnologies under investigation in laboratories around the world that look at how do you ameliorate those. And you can imagine, for instance, in the maritime industry, where steel is exposed to oxidative elements as a regular part of that industry's trade, something that could extend the life through self-repair of, say, a steel freight ship or something of those sorts, or the containers even that are on those freighters, could be very beneficial from a market point of view by making those very capital-intensive investments last longer in the harsh environments in which they operate. So that's the great positive of that this research has benefits for really helping bring the level of technology across the board in our culture up significantly. To address challenges that exist.
Okay, well, of course, all those things would be tremendous for mankind. And imagine, for example, somebody's totally paralyzed, as you mentioned, and being able to use his limbs because of this technology. Yeah. But the title of your article is a double-edged sword. What is the negative side?
Well, of course, as technology becomes more sophisticated, and this is not necessarily something that's restricted to a particular field of technological research, but I think across the board, as technology becomes more sophisticated, it becomes more powerful as applications are developed for it, those applications can be used for great good, and they sometimes can be misused for great ill effect as well. So we talked about, I mentioned the use of for drug delivery, for example. You can think of the many therapeutic ways in which very targeted drug delivery could have vast benefits for people who suffer injuries and disease. But what if a nefarious state actor, for instance, wanted to use that technology to build a more sophisticated and more difficult to track means of using chemical toxic agents for targeted means of assassination. Those types of things have been alleged to happen, but they're a little bit more clumsy with existing tech up till today. But you can imagine the more sophisticated technologies that might be developed along those lines using nanotechnology, and how would those be regulated? How would those be employed? Who would even know that they're taking place? It would be very difficult to track. And that opens up scenarios for a great deal of concern, I think, internationally and nationally, things that we have as a nation with our government have yet to grapple with, as a people have yet to understand with regard to how, as citizens of a republic, we regulate that within our government. And really, what are the threats that state actors who oppose us, let's say totalitarian states like communist China, how would they utilize that technology in ways that would harm Americans and the American nation? Those are great questions that have yet to be really addressed in any strong way.
Wouldn't necessarily have to be a foreign enemy, would it? Could it be somebody domestic?
Well, sure. You could find state actors or even non-state actors utilizing these technologies to a greater degree as they become more prevalent and available. And it makes the future world where these technologies are prevalent a more complicated world, and therefore a more dangerous world.
Mm-hmm. Now, your article is adapted from a new book that you've written that's not yet to be published, but will be published very soon.
Yes.
The name of that book is End Game.
Correct.
So how does this nanotechnology fit into the end game? And what do you mean by the end game?
Well, End Game is a book that takes a look at a large number of ideas that have been behind the rise of certain technologies and the adaptation of those technologies for certain purposes. And nanotechnology fits in that principally with regard to what some advocates of technological advancement call the singularity. And I think the key person behind that idea has been a man who's now an engineer at Google, and a high-ranking engineer at Google. His name is Ray Kurzweil. And for good or ill, Ray Kurzweil has written extensively and been very influential with regard to this idea that technology will progressively and exponentially advance to the point where human biology can transcend its form that it's existed in all of time thus far and be digitized and progress beyond a singularity, a point in time at which things have changed so substantially that we can no longer tell what the future of humanity will be like. Nanotechnology plays a role in that, and we see the role with regard to nanotechnology, I think most specifically where that road is going, with Facebook's change in name to Meta and their very advanced and aggressive attempt to build what they call the metaverse. And as you'll see in the technology news today, Facebook, or Meta now, has instituted a lot of patent activity with regard to new devices that can be used to track individuals within the virtual world of the metaverse that they hope to build. Those are at the macro scale, the scale that we live with every day from day to day. But there's research underway funded by DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agencies, taking place in labs across the country that utilize nanotechnological particles, magnetoelectric nanoparticles to be precise, that can be injected and that can be used to cross the blood-brain barrier and made up with every individual neuron. The Defense Department, as you can imagine, wants to be able to have this technology successfully able to help soldiers, you know, inelegantly stated, interface telepathically, sort of, with weapon systems. Now, you can see how that could progress to the same type of thing to allow individuals in the commercial market to interact with, in some sense, this inelegantly phrased telepathically with the metaverse. And at that point, you start having approaches to the singularity where we blur the lines between what is real and what is not real. At which point, once you cross that line, once you cross that singularity, we're in completely uncharted territory, as people like Ray Kurzweil, who advocates this, have described in the past. So nanotechnology, very fundamental to what is thought of amongst many of the cognoscenti and the technological elite, think is what's coming down the road with regard to virtual reality and the replacement of actual reality with that meta reality.
Is this something they want to have come about, and would they use that technology for the purpose of controlling mankind?
I don't think there's any question that that is the case. In fact, if you look at some of the reporting on the Facebook, or more properly, Meta patents that are in the news as of today, right now, this afternoon, you can see that there is a surveillance component to that. Mm-hmm. And it is, how does that entity, that corporate entity that's building the metaverse, track your activity within the virtual world? So it's inherent in the technology and in the move to this metaverse version of artificial reality, that you will have to be tracked. The tracking is fundamental to the success of that project.
Right. Now, you've used several times the phrase metaverse.
Yeah.
And it makes me think of The Matrix. Is that a good comparison of what we're talking about?
Yeah, I think The Matrix as a film, what you really mm-hmm. saw there was an artificial rendering of an alternative to reality. And that is essentially exactly what we're looking at. You saw also this week, as we record this earlier this week, Walmart venturing into the sale of virtual goods in the meta universe, in the metaverse. Mm-hmm. So it's not just Facebook, now known as Meta, but large corporate American entities, Walmart included, are now looking at actually selling digital goods in a non-real space to non-real versions of people who are looking to escape reality. And you can see the attraction, I think, that this will have, at least the potential attraction. It remains to be seen whether people will really go for this. But already, for decades now, people have been very sometimes overwhelmed by their capacity to fall into the video game culture, for instance, right. and really become consumed with playing various video games. This potentially takes that to an entirely new level of implementation, at which point it's possible there will be people who psychologically begin to have difficulty separating their life in the real world from their life in the virtual world, and may even prefer their life in the virtual world.
Well, is it possible they may not even know at some point? In other words, they could be in the virtual world while believing that's reality.
Yeah, fundamentally, you already have thinkers in philosophy and in physics, specifically speculative physics, who have wondered, are we already living in an artificial reality? And how could we tell if we were or if we weren't? I think if you carry that forward to the idea of the metaverse, you start to see how that could actually become mm-hmm. a real problem. Are we beyond the point where we think, therefore, we am? And what does that really mean in the future of a metaverse? How do we tell what's real versus what isn't real if this is implemented in the most sophisticated way that it could be? Now, that may sound like, well, we could never get there. But in 1970, just for instance, or 1980, just for instance, I don't think anyone living in either of those years could foresee that we are seeing something for real being constructed as artificial reality called Metaverse by one of the nation's largest companies, a social networking company, which itself is something that couldn't have been envisioned by someone living in 1980 or 84 or 88.
Right.
So we're seeing technology advance quickly and more quickly at all times, which underscores what Ray Kurzweil himself said, that technology is going to progress increasingly at a rapid pace, at which point he concluded that avoiding the technological singularity cannot be done, which, of course, he thinks it's a great idea that we reach that singularity, that point in time at which human life is transformed fundamentally forever thereafter. But I think the key point, whether or not that actually is realized, the key point is that technology is expanding and advancing at a much more rapid pace and increasingly so over time.
In addition to the article that you have in the January 31st issue regarding nanotechnology, you have another related article dealing with depopulation, the plan to depopulate or to reduce the Earth's population by design. That, too, is adapted from the same book that the nanotechnology material came from, In Game. What is the connection between depopulation and nanotechnology?
Well, at risk of revealing the entire contents of the book so no one has to read it, I don't want to have any spoilers in there. But this is very Malthusian in its approach. Mm-hmm. I'm referring, of course, by saying Malthusian to Thomas Malthus, the 18th mm-hmm. century philosopher economist who propounded that food production would be outstripped by population growth, and thus we must restrict population growth unless mm-hmm. we want to have a very large number of people starving to death in misery. And that has been disproven to be true. We have seen both in our own, we can look around and find that that's untrue just by observing our existing environment. Malthus could not have envisioned where we are today. He would have thought billions would have starved, billions upon billions would have starved, as opposed to what actually is the case today, where we have a food surplus despite having 7.5 billion people on the planet. Other economists who have been more modern, of course, than Thomas Malthus, Julian Simon comes to mind, pointed out that under market conditions, Scarcity leads to innovation, and innovation leads to solutions to scarcity. And thus, we likely will not run into food production shortfalls. And so far, Julian Simon, as opposed to the Malthusians, has been proven correct. But that doesn't mean the power of that Malthusian idea has been diminished in any way, shape, or form. And over the past 100 years, it's been extremely influential amongst the people who we might call the technocratic elite or the power elite or the insiders, as the New American has referenced them over time. These people have almost, by and large, completely been Malthusian in their outlook, have long believed that there are far too many people, often people who are, you know, deplorables in their mind, to use Hillary Clinton's term, and that population needs to be radically reduced. Otherwise, we're going to run into demographic problems that we don't want to have, or that they don't want to have, I should say. So this article that you're talking about population reduction, recounts that less than stellar history of people wishing to reduce the population of the planet. The way it relates, and again, I don't want to give too many spoilers for the book, but demographically, we already have questions circling about the implementation of certain advanced technologies, of which nanotechnology is one, and there are a few others, that many theorists are beginning to think will result in vast populations previously gainfully employed in a number of industries losing their jobs and never being able to find new jobs because the technology has made them surplus. And so this gives further impetus to the Malthusian idea. And that Malthusian idea has always been problematic, but when combined with ideas based in the technological expansion that we're witnessing and largely otherwise benefiting from, leads certain people to, I would say, conclusions that are at the very least incredibly dangerous. And so that's the connection.
Okay. We used the word deplorable, and of course in doing so, you were using the word that Hillary Clinton used.
Correct.
And of course you're using it in a negative way. Hillary Clinton used it in a very positive way, but as you're describing the context of depopulation and the deplorables that the elites want to get rid of, it made me think of what happened in Nazi Germany, where Hitler wanted to get rid of the useless eaters. Would you say that's the same principle?
That's exactly the same principle. And in fact, you'll find there's a chapter in the forthcoming book on that exact subject as well, focused not necessarily on the Nazis, but on the entire century of what it was called eugenics.
Right. Now, if you look what's happening today, it's really astounding. The more you learn about the vaccines, and of course, that's not the main subject of your book, but you touch on it.
Yes.
The COVID vaccines and the accumulating evidence that the vaccines are actually killing many more people than the COVID virus that the vaccines are supposed to cure. How does that fit in? Do you see that as maybe part of the strategy of depopulation?
Again, I don't want to give too many spoilers for the book, but I think that when you see things that have never happened before, that are completely outside the realm of normal lived experience that we all share over the past 40, 50, 60, 70, or 80 years, you have to start questioning the narrative that you're getting. And specifically, just take a look at the number of athletes, very highly trained, physically fit young men and women who have been collapsing on their fields of play and fields of practice over the past 6 or 8 months or 10 months. Having three such events would be unprecedented in a year, I would say. Having five would be unprecedented. Having dozens and dozens and dozens of them in a single year since the mass deployment of the vaccine, of young people succumbing from myocardia and from blood clots and all related sorts of things suddenly and inexplicably dropping dead, having heart attacks. Years ago we had one basketball player, a young basketball player, who passed away on the court, and it was major news because it was unheard of. These types of things don't happen. Sure, they can happen. There could be a congenital heart issue that the player is unaware of, and that was the case then. But that was huge news because it was so rare. You don't see a highly conditioned athlete dying like that. Now we're supposed to just say, well, that's just the way it has always been, despite dozens and dozens of these events taking place worldwide. Something is radically wrong. Something is far off, and it's being ignored. It's being suppressed, but you can't look away. And when you see these signals in the data, these are actual people who are suffering, and we need to ask, how long can we allow this to happen as a society? There's something clearly wrong.
Right. And actually, looking at all the documentation in your book, and of course I'm going beyond the two New American articles, there is no question that these things are not simply happening by accident, that they're happening by design. And of course, the New American Magazine is an affiliate publication of the John Birch Society. And since its founding in 1958, the John Birch Society has warned that American freedom is under attack, not just because of a war of ideas, although that's certainly part of it, but more so because powerful people in high places, and of course they include the communists, but they also include elitists who are not themselves communists, who work with the communists, cooperate with them, are working purposely to try to destroy freedom. So just to kind of wrap this up, is your view such that these conspirators for global control are certainly going to try to harness this new technology for no good and to do evil? And also, what can ordinary Americans do to prevent this from happening and save our republic?
Well, the answer on the technology side of things mm-hmm. is absolutely yes. Mm-hmm. Of course they are. That technology will be exploited for good and ill by anyone who can have access to it. Those who wish to exploit it for good within the market certainly will do so. They have every incentive to do so, and they should do so. We'll all benefit from that, just like any other market technology that's implemented. Mm-hmm. So more power to their research, and let's hope they do a great job with it and great things. I look forward to seeing what those are. And I look forward to benefiting from them, as I think we all will. But, you know, on the reverse side of that coin, I think that those who wish to do harm with those technologies absolutely will also try to do it if they think it can further their agenda. There's no reason to think that human nature has changed such that those people who wish to do ill with it, even if they think mm-hmm. they're doing good, will implement that technology to suit their ends. So we need to be aware. I think those things are inevitable. That's just human nature. What can we do about it, though, is I think the most important question of mm-hmm. all. And you mentioned the John Birch Society that the New American is affiliated with. The John Birch Society has always had a program that encouraged good civic engagement from informed Americans with their elected representatives at all levels of government, especially locally, especially at the state level, and, of course, at the level of the House of Representatives, the Senate, and any official that we can elect. That is foundational to preventing the loss of freedom in this country. And the loss of freedom in this country attends the loss of the Constitution. And now you see, especially with the Biden administration, they want to push forward certain legislation that would end the filibuster, of course. And they want to push through legislation that would federalize elections, which is now something that's handled at the state level, and appropriately so, with federalist mm-hmm. principles involved. Once those things are implemented, if those things are implemented, you start transitioning even more quickly from a constitutional republic to a one-party state. Those things can't be allowed to happen. If they do happen, a one-party state, once it's implemented, can simply get rid of impending rules and regulations, such as the Constitution, which limits the powers of the federal government. So the Constitution absolutely must be defended by an informed electorate. If we lose it, then we lose freedom everywhere, not just in the United States. And I point out in the book, and this is very, very important to keep in mind. Mm-hmm. We look at Australia and we see the incredible totalitarian nightmare that Australia has suffered under for the last year. We look at what's happening in some parts of Europe, in Austria. We look at what's happening in New Zealand and elsewhere. We look at what's happening aghast in Canada. You know, how can this have happened there? Mm-hmm. Most of those places and most everywhere else within the world have charters of government, so-called, where they give lip service to something that we recognize as our Bill of Rights. But always as they give lip service to enumerating the rights of their peoples, they give themselves an escape clause that, well, we respect freedom of speech unless it's inconvenient for us, in which case, you know, we can have so-called justified restrictions on freedom of speech. Those types of things mean there is no freedom of speech in those countries. It's not real. If the government can impose limits on freedom of speech at any time, you don't have freedom of speech. In contrast to the First Amendment of the United States, Congress shall make no law, period. That is an actual legal barrier to impediments on freedom of speech. However much the woke left wants to crack down on the First Amendment, it's very clear nonetheless, Congress shall make no law, period. And that's the difference between our Bill of Rights, our Constitution, and what's happening in other countries. I saw a video where a restaurateur, an owner of a restaurant in Canada, was aghast at the Canadian Gestapo showing up at her place of business and telling her she had to, comply with Canadian regulations on COVID or else shut down her restaurant. She said, this is an infringement on my rights. This is an infringement on our rights as Canadians. She's right, but strictly speaking, she has no rights in Canada because the Charter of Government in Canada says, yeah, you have these rights until it's inconvenient for us as the government. We can take them away and we can limit them.
Right.
In the United States, that can't happen. Now, the United States is a model for the world with its Bill of Rights and with its Constitution. And if it is maintained, if it's secured, freedom here means there's a model for freedom everywhere in the world. So it is more important, not just for us, our own selves as Americans, that we support and defend the Constitution and support our elected officials who are in favor of preventing detrimental activities against the Constitution. It's important not just for us, but for the world as a whole. If freedom fails here, it fails everywhere.
I agree with that completely. Dennis, thank you so much for joining this program.
You're welcome, Gary. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Okay, great. Dennis's book, The End Game, is not available yet. It will be a little bit later this year. But in the meantime, we encourage everybody to go to the January 31st issue of the New American Magazine. You can do that by clicking on the link below this video and to see that the two articles adapted from the book that we have published regarding nanotechnology and also depopulation. Thank you very much.